Hello, and welcome to this episode of Felonious, a podcast where we discuss the realm of true crime, from chilling cold cases to the wild and wacky. We'll explore it all with a perfect blend of seriousness and humour. My name is Emma.
And I'm Nazia. To keep up to date with what's coming up, be sure to follow us on Instagram at felonious.pod and visit our website feloniouspod.com. We hope you enjoy this episode, so let's get to it. So, what do we have this week?
This week's Bants. Chris actually told me about this story. I think he found out about it when he was in New Zealand.
When did he go to New Zealand?
When he was young.
This was published 19 years ago.
Yeah. I already feel old today because it's my nephew's birthday and he's 20.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
So 19 years ago, a bridge in New Zealand was stolen. It was a 30-metre aluminium bridge that paved the way to a wetland in New Zealand. And the people probably stole it to sell for scrap metal. The thieves took the base plates, side panels, and one entire section of framework from the bridge. But the bridge was there to help hikers and people in wheelchairs to access the wetlands.
Right.
And the items that they stole amounted to $37,500, which is quite a lot.
That is quite a job. I really wonder what goes through people's heads when they look at a bridge and they think,
yeah, I'm going to steal that tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that on my bucket list.
I mean, it's a lot of effort to go through and it's something so obvious. Like, I don't understand why. Especially if it's not even a bridge. You know, that's a nice bridge. It's giving people access to
nature.
Yeah.
Some people just want to destroy that and fill their pockets with dosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like what we're going to talk about today, really.
Yeah. But it reminds me of, because years and years ago, London Bridge actually got sent to America, like the original one.
Never knew that.
Yeah, it's in Arizona.
They don't teach you that in history lessons.
Oh. Fact of the day.
Is that where the nursery rhyme comes from then?
I don't know. I think that comes from the Great Fire of London, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Probably. We do have some really grim nursery rhymes.
We do. We have one about the plague.
Yeah, ring a ring of roses. Yeah.
I'll have to find out if there are any nursery rhymes like based on crime.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to find. If any listeners know of any, let us know.
Yeah.
But we'll do some digging ourselves. I suppose 19 years ago, you could get away with something. You could almost get away with something like that, stealing a bridge.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't have been like a populated area, would it? So.
No, that's true. Speaking of thefts, that brings us nicely to today's topic. So today we will be discussing the tale of Veran Tomic. I checked how to pronounce that name literally before.
How do you say it?
I think it's just Veran.
Veran. Okay.
Sorry, half French coming out there. I say we instead of yes these days. So today we will be discussing the tale of Veran Tomic, a notorious French Bosnian thief known for his involvement in one of the most audacious
arse heists.
I can never say. We are not talking about arse heists.
Not in today's episode.
No. Right. known for his involvement in one of the most audacious art heists. God, I had to really think about that in recent history. He single-handedly stole several valuable paintings from the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris in 2010 with a combined value estimated in the tens of millions of euros.
It's easy for you to say.
Yeah, it's not like last week's episode with all the Scandinavian. He was labelled the Spider-Man of Paris, but we think it's more accurate to call him the Peter Parkour of Paris. See what we did there? I'm surprised
you messaged me that.
Yeah. I'm surprised no one else picked up on it. One of the sources for this episode was a New Yorker article, but the other main source was the Netflix documentary, which is called it's called The Spider-Man of Paris, isn't it, or something like
that. Yeah. Yeah, we'll say that.
it's got a different title in French, obviously. But it was the French journalists that started calling him Spider-Man. But yeah, they missed out on Peter Parker. Parkour.
Parkour. Parkour.
Yeah.
There's no disclaimer in today's episode because it's mostly light stuff we'll be discussing.
Yeah, no one gets hurt.
Yeah.
Physically. So
it's a happy-ish episode.
It's quite a nice episode, I think, compared to the last...
In the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Compared to what we were talking about in the last 3 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Varane. Varane?
Yeah. Varane. I think it's a silent J.
Okay. I'm never quite sure because of my Swedish...
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about it.
Varane Tomic was born in Paris in 1968 to Bosnian parents. When he was a year old, his mother was in a car accident which left her unable to care for him. He was sent to Bosnia to be raised by his grandmother, and there he developed his devious tendency. He started to steal things when he was about 8 years old, and when he was 10, he broke into a library by climbing through a window which was 10 feet above street level. He stole 2 books, which were several hundred years old. The books were later returned by the brother of a friend. He returned to Paris at 11 years old, but he didn't speak much French and resented his parents, who were constantly fighting. His father was abusive towards him, hitting him on a regular basis. Tomic practically raised himself. He felt alone and rejected. He continued a life of petty crime, stealing whatever he could get his hands on. He would often steal car radios in order to sell them on and make good money. When he was a teenager, he became interested in drawing, and when he was 16, he was enraptured by Renoir's paintings. He wanted to become a painter himself, but his father said that painting was a hobby and not a real job. Instead, he wanted Varane to work in his garage as a mechanic. As a teenager, Tomic honed his parkour skills in Père Lachaise, Paris's largest cemetery, where people like Frédéric Chopin, Marcel Proust, Oscar Wilde, and Jim Morrison are buried. He was drawn to the tombstones. They became a parkour playground for him and his friends. He would squat in a nearby abandoned warehouse with his friends. They supported themselves by stealing glassware from a local factory and selling them in flea markets. They also started breaking into apartment buildings, climbing high walls, thanks to their parkour skills. During his teenage years, he would sometimes get into knife fights with other men. This stopped when he turned 18 and joined the army. He was one of the best climbers, and he learned a lot in the army. After a while, when his service had ended, he left the army and went back to stealing. He wanted to make a lot of money, so he would often burgle the homes of wealthy individuals. According to Tomic, the higher the building, the less secure it is. He climbed the facades of buildings using his hands, gripping the gaps in between the big bricks, and scaling drain pipes Some buildings had 10 or 15 floors. He enjoyed the adrenaline rush and it was addictive. He would observe apartments from the rooftops and would break through windows to get inside. He would often pick apartments with people inside as the alarms would not be active. He would check the bedrooms to make sure people were asleep and made sure not to make any noise while searching through their belongings. He never harmed anyone during his burglaries. He says in the documentary, very matter-of-factly, "If I'm a burglar and I go to your home, I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. Some people have more than others, so I'm going to help myself. We all see things differently."
I mean, he's very honest.
Yeah, but he's very cheeky at the same time.
Yeah, and we're both victims of thefts, home thefts.
We are?
Are we not?
Yeah, I am, but...
Did you not know about the house in Barking?
No.
It got broken into while my mum was...
Oh, yes, I remember now. Yeah.
I mean, they didn't steal anything, but they broke in.
But your mum was in the house, right?
Yeah, mum was in the house and she was praying because they saw my dad leave the house, so they thought it was empty.
Oh, okay.
Because she was in the back room, so all the lights at the front were off.
Mm.
And they broke in and I was coming back from work. See, it was quite scary for my mum.
Yeah,
as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Especially
in Barking, Jesus.
Yeah, and it was during a time where there was a lot of home burglaries happening.
Mm.
But it's a feeling of violation, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I can see where he's coming from his he's stealing rich people.
Yeah.
If I was a rich person, I think I'd kind of expect.
If I was a rich person, I would have bare walls, basically.
Yeah. Have everything in a safe, in a hidden safe. But I suppose, you know, what he says about people living on the higher floors, you wouldn't expect that though, would you? Like if you lived in a penthouse, you wouldn't expect someone to climb up all the walls and
make
the effort to like break into your apartment. So you can kind of understand from their point of view why they don't have any alarms and better security.
Yeah, they obviously don't believe in Spider-Man, so.
Yeah, not, well, they didn't then. I'm sure, I bet security's ramped up a bit now since he's become famous.
Yeah.
Maybe.
As Tomic became more skillful, he would often return to apartments more than once without taking anything, but to find the most expensive-looking items. One of his victims, Philippe Stark, explained in the New Yorker article, "I discovered that he'd been practically living with us in the apartment for a few days, spending his time soaring into my poor, small safety box without even disturbing us. It was very much a gentleman burglar situation. Arsène Lupin style, who is a fictional character who was a gentleman thief. And there is a Netflix show called Lupin."
Yeah, so there's a Netflix show based on a thief that's based on the fictional...
book, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's quite a good show, though. I recommend it.
I don't know. I don't know. I wasn't that bowled over by it. But I know people, yeah, I think it's one of the, it's quite divisive. Some people thought it was great, some people thought it was meh. But I like the actor. The main actor in that is amazing.
Omar Sy?
I don't know how to pronounce his surname. But yeah, he's an amazing actor.
On one occasion, when he was fleeing the police, Tomic hid in an empty apartment of a fashionable building. He started stealing the jewellery in there before the owner, an old man, came home with a very sexy girl. Tomic hid in the closet while the couple made love all night. He made his escape when they finally fell asleep. Oh, the lives of the rich and famous.
Yeah.
Tomic would often resist stealing valuable paintings from apartments because they were difficult to unload. But there were occasions where the temptation was overwhelming and he took what he found, including works by Degas and Signac, In 2000, he broke into an apartment while the occupants were sleeping with the use of a crossbow, ropes, and carabiners. He stole paintings worth more than €1 million. A victim called Veronica said that she felt safe living in her apartment as it was on the fifth floor. The burglar broke into her apartment via the balcony. As she was inside the apartment, the alarm was switched off. He stole €3 million worth of items while Veronica was sleeping. She felt violated and it affected her deeply. Her home didn't feel like her home anymore. Tomic says that he is not interested in knowing the victims. He just doesn't want them to discover him in their homes. He has a real hatred for rich people because of how pretentious they are and that money means nothing to them. He also says, "I know they're devious, depraved, and dishonest." Veronica, the victim, says that burglars only say stuff like this to absolve themselves of guilt. But no matter who the victim is, a burglary is an intrusion in a person's life.
In the documentary, she compares it to being raped, which, I don't know, I can kind of see where she's coming from, but at the same time, it is just material possessions. As long as you're not physically harmed.
Yeah, that trauma is easily healed compared to
having your body violated.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay, some artworks aren't replaceable, but you can just replace it with another artwork. You know, like when it's a burglary, unless it's something like a family heirloom or it's something sentimental, generally things can be replaced or they're disposable because it's just material objects. But
and some can be found, like, years later, which happened to us the other day.
Yeah, you actually got an item returned. Wasn't it like a year?
Yeah, so a year after our basement storage facility was burgled, we had returned to us an item that we listed as stolen, and someone had found it on a street somewhere that wasn't even nearby to us.
So random.
Yeah.
And the fact that it wasn't damaged.
Yeah, it was just as though it was just, you know, gone for a day or something.
Yeah.
The good police work. Thanks, Swedish police.
Doesn't happen everywhere or every time, so you're lucky there.
Yeah, definitely. But when we went into, it's like a lost and found building. Mm. They have all these like items on display. They have like metal plates taken from bicycles that have been stolen and never like reunited with their owner. So they just have this like massive frame with these metal like shields that go on bicycles. Yeah. And then on the other wall, they had like these racks and racks of lost keys.
Wow.
It's just that they were like, I want to say like thousands, but probably more like hundreds. But it was a lot.
Yeah. I mean, how long do they keep those for? Is there like a period where someone has to claim it by?
Yeah, they said to us, like they gave us a date of like the last pickup date. And they said, if you don't pick it up, we'll either sell it or destroy it.
They're obviously going to sell it, aren't they?
Well, it had a UK plug on it, I think that's why it was easily, well, it wasn't easily found, but I think that was why it was handed in.
Because like whoever stole it couldn't use it or sell it.
Yeah, basically.
It was useless to them.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's my story.
Yeah.
Burglaries were easy money for Tomic. He didn't need to get an ordinary job. At 25 years old, he would spend his money from stolen goods in fancy restaurants and pay women to sleep with him. Between 1994 and 2005, Tomic was in and out of prison. On one occasion, he was driving through Paris and ran out of gas in his car. He didn't have his wallet with him, but he had a toy pistol in the car. He decided to use it to rob a bakery. He got 200 francs, but a witness called the police with his car registration and he was later arrested. He was sentenced to a year in prison. Other convictions included selling drugs, aggravated robbery, theft with violence, issuing a death threat, and illegal possession of a weapon. During this period, Tomic realised that most people were choosing to not store their valuables inside their homes. So Tomic's attention turned to the art hanging in people's apartments. He researched them to discover their value and to see if he could sell them on. He is a big fan of the Impressionist movement. Once he stole 3 paintings by Renoir, which were worth millions, which led to him going to prison. In January 1999, the police got a tip-off and were able to arrest Tomic. They found Renoir paintings in the trunk of his car, and the police were surprised that he was able to steal so much stuff without resorting to violence. Considering how physically fit he was at the time, he could easily overthrow someone. Tomic is referred to as Spider-Man in the press. In 2004, Tomic met Jean.
We didn't learn from the Charles Sobrage series, no.
In 2004, Tomic met Jean-Michel Corvez, a business owner in his 50s, including a healthcare data company and a small gallery. They developed a business relationship, and over the years, Tomic sold Corvez approximately 90,000 euros worth of items, including jewellery, gold, and paintings. Corvez supplied a list of artists which his clients liked. In 2010, Corvez gave a list of 40 artists to Tomic and asked him to steal works by them. Tomic went looking for the art pieces in Paris. After a week of searching, he found
Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris,
aka MAM, the Museum of Modern Art, a major international institution housing many art pieces from the 20th century up until the present day. It is situated opposite the Eiffel Tower, along the River Seine, and up until this point had never been burgled.
The museum had high security with CCTV cameras on the roof, security guards and motion sensors. The works of art could be seen through the windows as there were no curtains. Tomic recognised a Picasso, a Braque, and a Matisse that were all hanging on the same wall. He knew he could make a lot of money if he stole them. He then went to see Corvez, who said that Tomic should steal as many pieces from the museum as possible. Tomic would get 50,000 euros for each painting he stole. Corvez reminded Tomic that he would love to have a leisure. The museum had a leisure 1922 painting, Still Life with Candlestick. Corvez offered Tomic $40,000 for it. This is when Tomic started the plans for his heist of the museum. Tomic did his research and his past experience of committing burglaries helped him. He observed the museum and its guards to see if they did their rounds inside and outside. Observing the guards on the outside, Tomic discovered that there was a gap of 2.5 hours between rounds. One night, he pretended to be a homeless person having a picnic outside one of the museum's windows. The window was blocked by a parapet from the security cameras. He was able to observe the guards' routines on the inside of the museum. He noticed the guards were walking past pieces of art without triggering the motion sensor alarms. Of course, they were not working. He noticed that some of the motion detectors stayed green when they should have flickered to red whenever anyone walked past them. This made Tomic more determined to carry out the heist. The screws on the window were encased in the framework. Tomic used his knife to remove the paint to uncover the screws in the window frame so that he could take them out and remove the window pane. He has done this on nearly every building he has burgled. He realised the museum window frames were just as weak. Before he could get inside the museum and carry out the job, he had to buy supplies. He bought paint stripper, suction pads, bolt cutters, a Stanley knife, a ladder, among other tools.
Just the normal shopping list then?
Yeah. He spent 2 hours a night trying to break into the museum via the window so that he wasn't spotted by the guards. He put up a curtain he had made to hide his presence at the window. He was concerned about the guards inside the museum seeing him at the window. He had to remove around 20 screws. For each screw, he first applied the paint stripper, then used a small sander to clean it, sprayed the screw with lubricant, and then he was able to drill it out. He then had to fill the holes so that nobody noticed the screws were missing. It took him 6 nights to do all of this.
It seems like a lot of work.
It's determination, but there's a lot of money to make. Like, if it had been completely successful right through to payout, that's a lot of money to make.
True.
He planned for this to be his last job, and he wanted to start living a normal life. He wanted to travel by buying a sailing boat. He was fed up with living in France, with the people and its society. What is it with French thieves and sailboats? Because there was Lillian Bettencourt.
Yeah, her finance manager.
Yeah, he wanted to buy a boat as well.
Yeah. French people love boats.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's not just a French thing. Maybe it's just a thief thing. I don't know. Something about getting boats.
So you can sail to your island in the Seychelles and...
Yeah.
Get money out of your Swiss bank accounts.
Yeah, that's probably it. The day of the robbery arrived, Tomek parked his car on the banks of the Seine and walked to the museum. He checked for potential threats to his plan. There were none. He used 2 crowbars to break open the frame of the window. Then he used suction cups on the window pane to remove it. He moved it to one side and then used bolt cutters to remove the security grille and lock. It made a loud bang, like a gunshot. It was a very tense moment for Tomek, who was worried that the guards had heard the noise, but he got inside. He saw a painting that was on his list, a Fernand Léger. He took it off the wall and took it outside through the window he had broken and hid the painting in a shaded area. He then went back inside the museum, into another room through some big doors that stayed open by a magnet. It made a big noise, which he wasn't happy about. He saw a little Matisse on the wall, and so he took it down, along with the Picasso and Braque that were next to it. He then took these outside and hid them next to the Léger painting. He then went back inside, wary about where the security guard was. He came across the famous Modigliani in another room, which he also took. As he was looking around for the other paintings on his list, he heard a noise. Scared that he would be caught, Tomek decided to leave the museum. He removed the frames to the paintings when he was outside. Then he had to cross the street holding 5 pretty expensive paintings. And it's very lucky it wasn't raining.
Yeah, and lightning.
Yeah. Or just very windy. He's lucky. He was lucky with the weather.
Yeah, no hurricanes that night.
Yeah. It was about 4 or 5 in the morning and cars were driving past, so there was a chance he would be seen. He managed to get to his car and put the paintings in the trunk. He then had a second thought about going back inside to get the other paintings that were on his list, but he chose to leave with the 5 paintings. He drove away from the museum, feeling triumphant over what he had stolen. He then came across a police checkpoint. Tomek felt like he had been caught, but the police just waved him through. So the New Yorker article that we also used for this episode, it describes the heist, but there's no mention of Corvez's list or the larger sum of payment that he promised to Tomek. So in the New Yorker article, Tomek just says that Corvez wanted a Léger and that he would get 40,000 euros for it. No. Yes,
he would get a lot of money for it.
He would get a lot of money, but not the full amount that's alleged in the Netflix documentary.
Mm.
But in the New Yorker article, he does say that Tomek stole multiple paintings, not just the one that Corvez especially wanted. And according to this article, Corvez met Tomek in an underground car park in Bastille in a rented Porsche Cayenne. Corvez was unnerved more than pleased when he realised Tomek had stolen 5 paintings instead of 1. Corvez agreed to take the Modigliani on consignment. Tomek asked him to store the other 3 on his behalf, but the conversation became tense when Tomek asked, "You could get hit by a car. Whose door will I knock on to recover my goods? So none of this is mentioned in the Netflix documentary.
No, it just depicts that they met in an underground car park.
Yeah.
And just handed over the paintings and set up a, like, Tomek would get paid, basically.
Yeah, but for the time being, he just got like a shoebox worth of cash, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. The stolen works were estimated to be worth more than $70 million, the biggest theft of its kind since 1990. An investigation was launched by France's elite armed robbery unit, the Brigade de Répression du Banditisme. They found a witness who was a skateboarder. He had seen a suspicious man on the esplanade outside the museum, observing the side of the wall and the windows of the museum. The police were hopeful that if they caught the burglar, then they would tell them where the paintings were. They found the frames to the paintings where Tomek had left them outside of the museum. The police chief was told that the museum alarm system didn't work and had been broken for several weeks. Fabrice Ergot, the director of the museum, said he was aware that the alarm didn't work, but he believed the museum had enough security that it wouldn't be a problem. The police searched for fingerprints and DNA. They were able to get hold of a CCTV footage, which showed a figure, but the image quality was very bad. The police had no leads and no evidence to suggest who had done this. 5 days later, Tomek was waiting to be paid. He was looking at sailing boats and was planning his getaway. He went to see Corvez, who handed over a shoebox full of money, but it was only 40,000 euros. Corvez then promised that he would get the rest of the money in a few days. So he went out and partied and even took homeless people out for dinner. One of them was called Guillaume, who Tomek took out for dinner on a number of times to posh restaurants. One night, Tomek got very drunk and started to tell Guillaume all about the museum burglary. The New Yorker article said that when Tomek collected his money from Corvez, he hailed a taxi, avoiding the metro so as not to be picked up on security cameras. He went to the apartment of a woman he trusted and spent the night there. The woman was a sex worker. They were confidants who helped each other. 6 months after the theft, police were tipped off with Tomek's name. The police then compared a photograph of Tomek with the description given by the skateboarder witness and concluded it was a match. So the police set up a surveillance team to keep an eye on Tomek to see if they could catch him committing an offence. They followed Tomek everywhere in order to find out who he was working for. They managed to monitor his phone calls and realised that Tomek spoke to very few people, but there was one number that Tomek would phone regularly. The number was traced back to a very bourgeois area of Paris, and so the police assumed that Tomek's handler lived there. But it turned out to be Guillaume, the homeless man. The police were still interested in Guillaume as he might have known something about the museum burglary. One night, Tomek called Guillaume. Tomek was drunk and the police found it difficult to understand him. But at one point, Tomek bragged about being the mastermind behind the burglary at the Museum of Modern Art. As Tomek was drunk when he made his confession, the police decided not to take it seriously, but they still kept an eye on him. Tomek became paranoid that he was being followed. He would climb buildings in order to lose a surveillance team following him. According to the New Yorker, detectives phoned Tomek and were greeted by a brazen voicemail which said, "If you want to buy paintings or works of art or exceptional jewellery, do not hesitate to contact me. Among the many paintings, there are five that are extremely expensive." 8 months after the burglary, Tomek was still waiting for the rest of his money. He considered Corvez to be unprofessional. Tomek grew suspicious of Corvez, who became difficult to contact. Corvez gave no guarantees about the paintings. Tomek then taped one of the conversations he had with Corvez to have evidence of his involvement in the crime. Corvez had sold the Leger for 80,000 euros, but the buyer returned the painting without a refund as they were spooked by the media attention. As Tomek was running out of money at this point, he continued to work for Corvez, even though he didn't trust him. He said he had no other choice. The police still had Tomek under surveillance, and they followed him to an antiques shop. Tomek was in the shop for about 10 to 15 minutes and then left. Corvez left shortly after. Corvez wasn't known to the police at the time, but they decided to keep an eye on him and discovered that he had contact with some of the biggest criminals in Paris, all of whom were burglars.
The police realised that Tomic and Corvez knew each other very well and would see each other frequently. They also discovered a regular acquaintance of Corvez, a man named Jonathan Bian. Bian had a bourgeois lifestyle with a wife and family and owned a luxury watch repair shop. He came across as an ordinary man, but he was selling stolen merchandise. The 33-year-old watchmaker bought the Modigliani. He persuaded an employee at the Crédit du Nord to store it in a safety deposit vault off the books. The four other paintings were stored in an armoire in Bian's shop, which had a sophisticated alarm system. In late December 2010, while the French police were looking in on Tomic, Bian flew to Tel Aviv, Israel. He communicated with Corvez about arranging a sale, suggesting that they were optimistic about passing through some legal obstacles. Corvez mentioned the possibility of finding a buyer in Israel, hinting at a Russian Jew who might be interested in purchasing the stolen paintings. Israel adhered to a legal concept called market overt, where if an object is sold during daylight hours in an open marketplace, its origin cannot be questioned. The idea is that if the object had been stolen, its rightful owner would have the opportunity to claim it before the end of the day. The concept dated back to medieval England, but was abolished in 1990 after two stolen paintings were sold at a flea market for a fraction of their value. In another recorded phone conversation in 2011, Corvez told Tomic, "I would have preferred that you didn't bring me these things because I don't know what to do with them anymore. I'm sick of it." Tomic was at this point desperate for money. He pawned a diamond to Corvez for 400 euros. Corvez wasn't interested in commissioning another theft of a valuable painting. At this point, the police were following Tomic at night and were hoping to catch him in the act. They knew that he was committing other burglaries. Tomic was very athletic and could walk for a long time to find the right victim. The police followed him to a gun shop, where he was looking through the window at a crossbow with a grappling hook. He continued to walk around the nice neighbourhoods in Paris and case the Pompidou Centre. The police thought he was assessing the building and whether he would be able to climb it. Tomic said that he planned to climb the building opposite the museum and walk along the roof. He would then shoot a grappling hook to the museum building on the other side of the street and use the cord to get across. But Tomic didn't have the time to commit the burglary in the end. He continued to look at apartments that he could burgle on Montaigne Avenue, a nice neighbourhood in Paris. One night, Tomic broke into a duplex close to the Canadian Embassy. The lights were on, but no one was home. He found a collection of watches, valuable works of art, a crocodile briefcase with a false bottom, and a gun. He left that night as he was running out of time, but he made approximately 15 visits to the apartment hoping to find hidden treasures, but he found nothing. On the 12th of May 2011, Tomic broke into the house again. He climbed up to the roof and got in through the window. He stole a Metzinger, a Pissarro, 200 grams of jewellery and 10 collectible watches, a hoard worth 2 million euros, which Corvez allegedly agreed to buy. He put the stuff in his car and the police followed his vehicle. The police waited for him to return home before giving the go-ahead for his arrest. Tomic acted calm while the police went through the items in his car. He admitted to stealing items and told the police where he had got them from. He was then taken to the police station. The victim said that Tomic was talented, that he was just a burglar and that he didn't kill or harm anyone. He was just glad to have his stuff returned. He found it amazing that the police spoke about Tomic with respect. The victim makes a joke to Tomic in the documentary about a painting by Gallien that Tomic had stolen. The victim was pissed off that Tomic had stolen it because the artist wasn't well known. He says in the documentary, "Tomic, if you come back, steal whatever you want, but not this one." That guy was quite funny, actually.
Yeah, he was.
Tomic was taken into custody and Corvez was arrested. The police found Corvez to be very unpleasant and he claimed he had nothing to do with the crimes. The police were still unsure if Corvez was the receiver of the paintings from the Museum of Modern Art, and they didn't know Tomik stole them. The police decided to tell Tomik that they had arrested Corvez. Tomik then agreed to work with the police to free himself from Corvez. He was still very angry with Corvez for not giving the full 250,000 euros he had been promised. During the interrogation, Tomik confessed to the duplex robbery and the heist. Tomik's confession is not public record. His lawyer was not present, but explained that Tomik felt he had to confess as it would reasonably sound like repentance instead of having to maintain a lie. The prosecutor,
Anaïs Trubuy,
believes Tomik confessed because he was proud of his work. A court-appointed psychologist came to a similar conclusion, describing Tomik as a visionary.
The police continued to interview Corvez, who realised he was in deep shit. He told the police that he gave the paintings to Jonathan Byrne to hold onto for a while. So the police arrested Jonathan Byrne. The police realised that Jonathan was a compulsive liar and wasn't willing to cooperate. He told the police, however, that he destroyed the paintings out of panic and threw them in the building's garbage. Tomik couldn't believe that the paintings had been destroyed and didn't understand why Jonathan would have done so. The police didn't believe Jonathan either because of his ability to lie. I don't know if I say this later on, but I think even his own wife didn't believe him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's mentioned in the New Yorker article. In 2017, during the trial, Tomik explained to the media that he regretted breaking into the museum and stealing the paintings. According to the New Yorker, the public were falling for Tomik, as French people are very fond of thieves' stories when there is no blood. And journalists began referring to him as Spider-Man, even though, during the heist itself, it didn't involve any climbing or parkour.
No, he just went through a window.
Yeah.
That was on the ground floor.
Yeah, and the security cameras weren't working. So, and the motion sensors. So he had quite an easy job, really.
Yeah, he just had to remove some screws and that was it.
Yeah. Tomik never hurt anyone when he committed his robberies. He robbed a poorly supervised museum and he was polite to the judges. Tomik was proud of his masterpiece heist and compared himself to Arsène Lupin. Corvez was careful in court, saying he never asked Tomik to steal, but said if he happened to stumble upon a leisure, he knew of a buyer, but he never revealed the identity of this buyer, claiming it would threaten his safety. The lawyer of Burns argued he was manipulated by Corvez. Byrne declared he destroyed the paintings because he was paranoid that he was being watched and followed by the police. However, as we mentioned before, not many people believed this, including his wife. The prosecutor said of the three men, "They know very well that the day they get out of prison, the paintings will not have lost value and they will be able to resell them." Jonathan was sentenced for 6 years. Corvez got 7 years and his possessions and his house were taken away. Tomik received an 8-year sentence. They had to pay out 104 million euros to the city of Paris as compensation. Many believed he knew where the paintings were. If it were the case that Tomik knew where the paintings were, legally nothing can be done. In France, individuals cannot be prosecuted for perjury in the same way as in other countries. There is no specific offence for perjury, but there are penalties for providing false testimony or false evidence in court if it can be proven by prosecutors. However, the consequences are not as severe as those for perjury in other jurisdictions.
I can't believe that.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe it's also the same in Denmark, because when I was learning about the Kim Wall murder, I think her killer, I think he lied in court and...
he lied about a lot of things.
I mean, that's a more serious and messed up case. But if I'm not mistaken, I think in Denmark you can get away with lying in court as well, which is weird.
Yeah, very weird.
If the paintings are ever found, is likely that the notoriety of their theft will add to their value. And we spoke about this in the Alphonse Bertillon case.
Yeah.
So when the Mona Lisa was stolen in 1911 from the Louvre, It was at that time a relatively uncelebrated painting. However, the attention of its theft made it the most famous painting in the world.
It's not even that great, that painting.
No.
Gotta be honest.
I've seen it in real life and it's a bit meh.
Yeah. When I went to see it at the Louvre.
Yeah.
There was just like a crowd of people surrounding it. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's quite underwhelming, if I say so myself.
I think it's one of the most reproduced images in the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just mad.
But, I mean, I guess that theft made it famous, bizarrely. In 2022, Tomic was released. He was proud of what he had done at the museum and would often say that only he could come up with the idea. He believes the paintings were not destroyed and is adamant about finding them. The police are still confident that the paintings will be found. At the end of the documentary, Corvez is asked if he knows where the paintings are. He evades the film crew and asks to be left alone. He is followed and threatens the film crew with violence if they don't stop harassing him. He says, "Respect my freedom, okay? I paid my debt. I went to prison. I was sentenced to 7 years. I did my time. Now I'm relaxed. I want to be left alone. Do you understand that?" He then walks away and he's questioned again about the paintings and he says, "Do you want me to hit you? You're being aggressive. Do you want me to hit you? I'm inclined to do so." Grumpy old shit. So at the end of the documentary, we also learn that Tomic, he falls in love.
Oh, yeah.
Love is all that matters in the end, isn't it? So his girlfriend, she, in the New Yorker article, she explains that Tomic resents his parents from taking him away from Bosnia. She also explains that when he loves a work, so a painting, he wants to possess it. It's an uncontrollable impulse. He wants, he takes. And Tomic told Jake Halpern, the journalist who wrote the New Yorker article, that he hadn't stolen many of the paintings he saw during his break-ins in apartments because he doesn't have an apartment big enough and secure enough to store a private collection. But he explains that if I had this privilege, I would have acquired a museum by today. I can assure you that.
So he's an illegal art collector.
Basically, yeah. But then he says that he has stolen works and kept them for himself, probably not many. So I'm assuming the police must have seized those when they raided his apartment.
Yeah, I would assume so.
Yeah. So one conclusion is I learned how to say Guillaume properly. There you go. I've marginally improved my French, which...
From the help of your partner.
Yes.
Oh, I learned from Chris that I said mispronunciation wrong in one episode.
Really?
Yeah, I said mispronunciation.
Probably went over my head.
Probably did mine as well. So I'm just wondering what things he's going to comment from this episode that I've said wrong.
Yeah. We're very tired.
If it's the French stuff, piss off.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even get the French stuff right. But yeah, I can't really say much about this because he is quite charismatic.
Yeah, even his, well, one victim didn't like him, but even his victims are just like, they can't believe how brazen he is. And like I think part of them admires his love of art, maybe.
Yeah, because he's got a very sophisticated taste combined with having incredible athletic abilities. So it's hard not to be impressed.
But it is quite scary how he would just like camp out in people's apartments while they were still home.
Yeah, I mean, if I was like someone that lived in, I don't know, if you want to call it a penthouse, or if I lived on like the whatever floor, the highest floor of an apartment building in a rich part of Paris, and knowing that while I'm sleeping, there's this tall, dark figure looming around the house and
yeah,
like chipping away in my safes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a really, really uncomfortable. Like, yeah, I can sort of get what that woman was saying, because you don't feel safe. It is that vulnerability. But they are incredibly lucky that he's not. He wasn't
violent.
Yeah, he's not a sicko. That would, because if he was sick in the head, he could use that to his advantage and actually, like, harm people.
You say that. He did hold up a bakery with a toy pistol.
With a pistol.
And sold 200 francs.
Yeah, but he needed gas money.
Oh, that's all right then. I'm surprised he didn't use a baguette instead of the toy pistol.
I was just
going to
say, he didn't assault anyone with a baguette.
Throw a croissant at someone.
Like, you know, if it could be more sinister, and he could be someone actually physically harming people. But he just wants some really nice paintings.
Yeah, and some dosh.
And some nice jewellery.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really have much to say on this.
Mm. The Jonathan Bian character, yeah. He's quite interesting as well. Because no one believes that he destroyed the paintings.
And he was like, apparently, like, breaking down in tears in court, whereas Tomek was completely composed.
Yeah.
There were two opposite ends of the spectrum.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all we can say about that, really.
Yeah. I mean, he's out of prison now, and hopefully he's leading a nice life. I mean, it's a shame, because he could have used his abilities for something that wouldn't land him in prison.
Yeah. It, like I said, he could have been like an art dealer or a legit art collector.
Yeah, or just an actual athlete, you know,
yeah,
doing parkour.
Yeah.
Because he's incredibly skilled.
He could have got a contract with Red Bull or something.
Yeah, got on some sports sponsorship.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that. We're kind of going into Bosnia for the next episode, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're going to take things down a notch.
Yeah, a couple of notches, really.
It's not going to be a nice one. So who are we talking about next week?
I can only remember his surname, Mladic.
Ratko.
Mladic.
What a name.
Yeah. Otherwise known as the Butcher of Bosnia.
Yeah.
And during the war in the, well, the wars in Yugoslavia, he was part of the genocide against, was it 7,000 Muslim men and boys?
Yeah. Was it just men and boys?
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and we're watching at the moment a documentary on the court case.
The Hague trial.
Yeah, the Hague trial, bringing charges of genocide. Yeah, so that's going to be on our next episode.
Yeah. Another genocide episode. Because there isn't enough of that going on at the moment, is there?
No.
So, it's not a genocide, it's a humanitarian crisis, remember?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's bullshit is what it is.
Yeah, absolute bullshit.
But you can subscribe and listen to us on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts.
Oh, fucking cow.
Or wherever you get yours. And Nausea's cats seem interested by that, as one has just jumped onto the table and climbed over her.
I think she's saying she's ready for bed.
Catch your next dose of cat entertainment next Tuesday.
Anyway, see you next Tuesday, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find more information about the show on our website at feloniouspod.com or on our Instagram at feloniouspod.
Links to our show notes can be found in the episode description, as well as through our website and social media. You can visit our Contact Us page and tell us what you think about the show and if there are any cases you would like us to cover. We hope you join us for the next episode. Goodbye.
Bye.